Hi, Sheila. How are you?
I'm very well. How are you?
Oh, great. I've had my morning cocktail already.
Have you really?
No.
No, I was just going to
The
ask.
research, it just goes on and on.
Do you ever have a hangover?
I think it's a tolerance thing, but no, I haven't had one for a while.
How do you avoid it? I know you expectorate.
Yeah. Oh, yes. That's right. The gentil word for spitting.
Yes, exactly.
I do try when I'm tasting. Yes, you sit down and taste 200 wines at once, and you'll be sloshed pretty quickly if you're not.
Absolutely. That bottle of wine, Natalie McLean, must have been some bottle, eh?
It was my, I guess, my Madeleine. I still remember it, and it's why I started off the book with that memory, because it just brought so much to my senses, to my mind, and yet it made me curious, and it really set the whole thing in motion of wanting to learn more about wine.
Why do you think it struck such a chord?
I think because there's something about wine that is a full five senses kind of experience. So it can strike you intellectually, and a lot of people love to talk about wine and the regions and the aromas they're getting and that sort of thing. Then there's the sensory pleasure of it. And I think something that often gets ignored, there's alcohol in wine.
There's a
So
buzz.
yeah, there's the buzz. That's why we don't have a lot of orange juice critics. So I just think that whole multifaceted aspect of wine is what drew me to it and made me so curious to learn more.
Just in case anyone's wondering what the wine was, it was a Brunello in
Yeah.
your neighborhood Italian eatery.
Exactly.
And I've noticed a slight theme through the book. When a wine really works for you, it seems to have an effect on your thighs. Have you noticed that?
It's because I have big thighs. I don't know. It's there first.
But this one flushed warmth up my cheeks, down through my shoulders, across my thighs. Sounds
Yes.
almost dangerous.
Yes, it is. It's a full body experience, though. I think maybe part of that comes from the fact I was a Highland dancer, and so I experience food and wine with my whole body. Kind of just dive right in,
I
thighs
was
and
a
all.
Highland dancer too.
Oh,
Funny where it can lead you, isn't it?
were you? Absolutely. It must be all those wee drams that kept sneaking or something.
It must have been. But you're interested in the nuance as well.
Am, because wine, is encyclopedic in a way, and I don't mean that to sound intimidating, but you can go as deep as you want. So you can stay at the hedonistic level, the I like it, so this is what I drink, but you can dig so deep with wine. You can get into the layers of aromas and what's going on in the wine and why does it smell that way? Why does it taste that way? Because there are infinite number of influences, the soil, the decisions the winemaker made, the region it comes from. There's just so much bundled into that glass.
One of the first things you realize about wine is that it engages you both on a sensual level, but also intellectually. How does that work?
I like trying to figure out wine. So I like to figure out what's going on in my glass, but also what's going on around the glass, because there's so many aspects that wine ties to. It may be my worldview at this point, but to me, wine connects to culture and religion and science and commerce. You could do, I think, an undergraduate degree just using wine as the thread through all the programs that you take, because wine flows through history and culture, so many endeavors for us that's what engages me intellectually, trying to figure out all those connections.
Tell me what you were before you were a wine critic.
I was a high-tech geek. Traditional path to wine writing, it was not. I finished off an MBA and then went into high-tech marketing. And was really enjoying that, and that's kind of why I now have a website that you mentioned that still fascinates me. But I was actually on maternity leave, and as I say, only in a sleep-deprived state would you think it made any sense to go from high-tech marketing to, yeah, I'll write about wine. I'd actually taken a sommelier course before then. Was wandering around a grocery store one day looking for diapers, I think, and picked up the magazine in that food store. They didn't have a wine column, so I called up the editor, just cold called her, and said, "Would you like an article about wine on the internet?" Because I figured I know a little bit about wine, a little bit about the internet, I can do this. And she said, "Have you been published?" And I said, "Yes," thinking of my high school newspaper. "Don't ask for samples, please." And she gave me the column, and then eventually that led to other assignments, and I knew this is what I wanted to do.
One of the winemakers from California in your book describes today's food and wine pairings as two monologues. What do you think he meant by that?
I think they're following separate paths, food and wine innovation. I think they can come together, but what's happening on the food front is that you're getting a lot of experimentation, a lot of fusion, a lot of foamy stuff and innovation going on, but you're also getting that on the wine side. So people are going off with new styles. A lot of wines are becoming very alcoholic, so into the 14 to 16% range.
Especially New World wines.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a palate whacker of a wine. And it also can just obliterate the food that you're trying to put it with. And so I think what he's getting at is that when you have such strong flavors on the dish and in the glass with a lot of alcohol, they're just duking it out on your table. And it's not the harmonious pairing that it could be.
I have a friend who I won't name her name, but I'm sure she's listening, who buys wine by alcohol content.
Ah, the higher the better?
The higher the better.
Oh, excellent. She's really getting a bang for her buck.
Is she getting anything else?
Yeah, absolutely. There's nothing wrong with high alcohol wines if that's what you prefer in terms of your taste, your personal taste, because wine is very personal. There are no, right and wrong or whatever. But when it comes to really high alcohol wines, they do start to knock out some of the more subtle aromas. It's kind of like the guy on steroids and kicking sand in the face of the, weakling on the beach. Those flavors are lost under that welterweight of alcohol. And so I think there's a trend these days to try to pull that back and get back to a more balanced kind of wine. But if you love your big strapping Aussie Shiraz at 15%, go for it.
Which Europeans are still a little bit sniffy about.
They are very sniffy, but they can't afford to just sniff anymore, sit back and sniff, that is, because Australia and other New World countries are eating their lunch. France is having a real challenge now in a lot of New World countries competing, including Canada and the US, where Australian wines are now number one in terms of sales. They've trounced the French.
What did you discover, though, as you went to France for the first time?
Sorry, what did I discover?
Yeah.
The wines, I fell in love with the wines there. The Pinot Noir especially, the heartbreak grape. I think it's a heartbreak both for winemakers and those who drink it because you'll keep coming back looking for more and it'll tease you. But I went to some of the most famous vineyards in Burgundy. And Burgundy is a very small little wine region with little patches and it's almost impossible to figure out unless you go and visit and put that sensory map inside yourself as you taste the wines standing on the soil where those vines have grown. And I tasted one of the famous ones was Domaine Romani Conti, and I'll just never forget it. It just fluttered out of the glass and surrounded me with just such opulent aromas and flavors. It was gorgeous.
You describe the Pinot Noir the first time you mention it has a feral caprice and dazzling aromas of black cherries, roses, cinnamon, clove, mushrooms, and fresh turned earth. William Shakespeare described it as a marvelous searching wine, and it perfumes the blood ere one can say, "What's this?"
Yes,
Oh, it sounds divine.
it does. Just you want more, and perhaps I had a few glasses by that time. That description sounds like I did.
Do you write right after you drink?
Yeah, that can be a danger, though. I do try to capture how I'm feeling at the time, but then sometimes I'll go back to my notes and all I have is, and I think I've written something intelligent.
I had a little note from you once when we had our wine panel with Conrad Ejbic and Jürgen Goff. And I had mentioned that one of the wines I tasted had a little peach resonance.
Yes.
And you suggested that women had perhaps a more highly developed palate.
There's some studies that suggest this. It's interesting. Some theories say that women have better taste, senses of taste, because they actually have more taste buds. Others say that women are the natural tasters because, from an evolutionary standpoint, they were the cooks in the family traditionally. They were also the ones testing the berries to make sure they weren't poisonous for the children. There is some evidence, although it's not conclusive. A lot of winemakers that I meet, whom I meet, often say this, that their wives are better tasters than they are, but who knows?
I'm speaking with Natalie McLean. She's in Ottawa, and she is the author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over, a wine-soaked journey from grape to glass. Natalie McLean is a wine critic. One of the things that I was fascinated by in your book is the connection that women have with wine in the wineries of the old world. I mean, I knew about Veuve Clicquot, and the veuve is a real signal that a widow was involved in all of this. But women are fairly central, aren't they?
They are. Most of the great champagne houses at the turn of the century were run by women. Veuve Clicquot was one of them, but there was Pommery, Bollinger, a whole host of them, because these young women who were mostly in their 20s and 30s had either lost their husbands to war or to sickness. And they were running what were, for the time, France's largest corporations at a time women just weren't in business. So it's pretty amazing because they then built these brands into some of the most famous luxury brands we have in the market. And so they're there, and then women's presence, I think, today is being felt more and more. I came across a surprising statistic while I was researching this book. Women actually buy 77% of wine and drink 60% of it.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I was shocked because I thought it was, well, I guess you do think of men being the traditional wine connoisseurs if you have an image in your mind of a bow tie snob, but women are actually more and more part of the mix and an important part of the marketing. And now you're seeing wines that are designed and made to be targeted to women. So there's one called Little White Lie, and on the cork it says, "Oh, this old thing, it's not new."
That's great.
Yeah.
Tell me about La Tigresse, the tigress.
Ah, La Lou. La Lou Bise Laroy is a famous winemaker in Burgundy. She was 50% owner in Domaine Romanée-Conti, probably Burgundy and if not France's best wine. There was a bit of a fallout at the winery, and she started her own winery. That was the reason for the fallout. They felt she was competing. But nonetheless, she has a fiery temper, and she is a petite woman. So I knew I had to meet her while I was in France because I really was searching out the most charismatic personalities because I thought that would be the most interesting way to talk about wine. And so I'd heard Lalou has her babies, her dogs. And I don't have animals, so I'm not a foe of furry friends, but I'm not exactly comfortable. But anyway, they came yapping to the door as I knocked, and then she arrived. And she was this little petite woman in haute-couture and girlish bangs, and she had climbed Mount Blanc about a couple of years ago before I had met her. She was 73. She was amazing. She had such intensity in her eyes, and we tried to talk franglais for a while, trying to communicate. And eventually her vineyard manager came over because my French is rusty, but she talked about her biodynamic viticulture, and so that has a lot of interesting tenets to it, including burying bull's horns in the vineyards and harvesting according to the zodiac and so on. It actually has some sound sense to it in that it's respecting the earth and recognizing the seasons, but there's that added element that some people believe is kind of maybe a bit witchcrafty.
Wiccan, a little Wiccan, maybe.
Yeah, yes.
She is an intimidating character.
She is. She is. She felt like a school teacher that I never quite pleased. And so I sat there tasting her wines, thinking, oh, now what can I say? Yes, it's very good, madame. It's very good. And so at one point she says, well, you know, wine writers, they're all just so silly. They write about every silly berry on the planet. And so we both sit there sort of grimly shaking our heads about the stupidity of wine writers. It was just bizarre. Her chicken was burning. She was, it was just a very interesting kind of lunch and tasting with her.
How did winemakers in California feel about wine critics like yourself?
Well, I think critics helped a lot to establish California and other New World countries, to break the lock that France and other traditional Old World countries had on the wine market here, and to give consumers here confidence that the wines coming out of California, Niagara, Australia were worth drinking. So one of the most powerful critics is Robert Parker from the U.S., and he's the one who popularized scoring wines out of 100. And that's what North American consumers were looking for, some sort of shorthand way to say this is a good wine, because legally at least you can't try the wine before you open it. So all you've got to go on is, do you like a castle in the middle distance or a fluffy squirrel? So these critics kind of opened the market to say, yes, have the confidence that this California Cabernet might be worth trying. And there's been debate ever since about the power of critics and can you rate wine? Can you put a number on a subjective experience? But I think they really did give people the confidence to try our wines here.
You score your wines.
I do.
You give out ratings.
Yes.
The practice is, it is controversial because I suppose the difference between an 89 and 90, while it doesn't look like much on the paper, is a lot out in the market, isn't it?
It is. It is. There's an adage in the industry that says a wine scored 80 or under can't be sold because everybody thinks it's no good. A wine scored 90 or higher can't be bought because the demand is so high. And there's a chasm that separates 89 and 90. We rate a lot of things in our culture, movies, books, and all sorts of things. And people really perceive a huge difference between an 89 and a 90. And yet, when you're a critic or a wine writer, you think, this is so subjective. And I resisted rating wines for the first three or four years that I was writing about wines. But people asked and asked and asked, and I finally caved in. I thought, if I can give wine lovers a tool that they find useful, that will help them to broaden their palate or try new wines or give them confidence, then so be it. I'm all for it.
Early in the book, you spend a day picking grapes. Tell me what that was like.
I ruined my manicure. It was great. I think the what I was trying to do was experience how wine is made or harvested rather than just talk about it. I just thought it would be a more interesting way to do it. So this was with Randall Graham, that crazy California winemaker at Bonnie Dune Vineyards. And I asked if I could participate in the harvest. So he gave me the full-on treatment, and I was out there helping pick the grapes, test them in terms of the sugar levels in the grapes and that sort of thing. And it is back-breaking work. That expression about low-hanging fruit, it'll kill you because you're bending down every time to pick the ripest grapes, which are hanging along the bottom. And a lot of these vineyards are terraced because you want good drainage for the vines. So you're walking uphill and downhill and your pail's getting heavier and heavier and heavier. But the whole experience at the same time was very meditative because my body was so engaged that my mind was able to wander freely and think about the experience and just how beautiful it was to be out in those leafy vineyards and the September sun beating down on the back of my neck. It was pretty glorious, even though it was hard work.
In another vineyard, you come face on frontal to the tending of the vineyard and actually when to cut the vines, right?
Yes. At Domaine Romani Conti, I went in February, which is definitely not tourist season. It's cold, it's windy, and so we're out in these sort of among the scarecrow vines because they're leafless and they're gray and they look like they're shivering, and they're getting cut back because that's the time in the life of a vine when you trim it so that it'll be ready to grow the fall harvest. And so in my spirit of I want to participate, I asked the winemaker, Aubert de Villaine of Domaine Romani Conti, if I could cut a vine. And he said, absolutely not. And I thought, oh no, I've offended him. I've been here 15 minutes. How could I be so audacious as to think I could cut a vine and make a $1,000 mistake or something? And he actually said, no, it's not that. It's too dangerous because they use these automatic power generated clippers so that they can go through the vines more quickly. It's still done by hand, but they're very fast, and it's easy to mistake a vine for a pinky finger.
Does price always mean quality, Natalie?
It does to a certain extent, and then it just doesn't. So what I mean by that is that there are a host of factors that contribute to the cost of wine, from the kind of the plot of the vineyard. So where is it? Does it have good sun exposure? That sort of thing. You're going to pay more for a good plot of earth. Did you pay a design firm $100,000 to design your label? And it's competitive too. So in areas like California and Bordeaux, often winemakers will price their wines in competition with their neighbors, that is higher, so that they communicate the message that this wine is so valuable, it's worth your money. So yes and no, but there are a lot of great values on the market these days at $10 to $15. Surprisingly well-made wines, because the technology has moved forward so much. There are so many wine regions now making wine. It's very competitive, and so you don't have to pay $500 a bottle to get something really great anymore.
Do you know what you're going to drink tonight?
Oh, I'm actually a fan, or a huge fan, of Canadian wines. One of my favorite is Vineland Estates, an off-dry Riesling from Niagara. And it is a zippy little sipper that goes with just about anything, from chicken to salad to seafood.
Sounds great.